I want to get your views on this this recent shutdown fiasco. So obviously it was, I think, 43 days, a new record, the second record, which of course the first one was also under the Trump administration. And this one was characterized, and I've done a number of shows on this up to this point. And to me, it was really characterized on the Republican side, especially of just this gross mocking of the system, the insulting of the intelligence of the American people by saying things that were self-evidently untrue and saying with a lot of gusto, just outright lies about what the Democratic Party, why they were doing this, why, what they were believing, what they were trying to get, which is categorically against what it was. It was all about helping the people with these ACA. Now, I'm not a shilling for the Democrats. In fact, I'm opposed to the Democrats in a number of different categories, and I don't consider myself part of either party. But at least on this one issue, the Democrats were indeed fighting for these ACA extensions, which is, makes health care, as bad as it may be and as problematic as the ACA may be, it still is health care, and they get something that they can at least afford with the subsidies. Now, you take these subsidies off, and millions of people are going to lose their health care, or it's going to just devastate their finances and make them have to cut back in other things to just to survive, et cetera. And it's going to really put a big burden on them. And that's what the Democrats were trying to get done. The Republicans seemed to oblivious to that. They literally went to the Supreme Court to keep paying SNAP benefits when they had the money and a direct order from the court to do so. I still don't understand why they did that. And then now then the Democrats are saying, all right, after this big blue wave that happened a week ago on Tuesday, where they won all these things, and it looked like they had a lot of headwinds because it was so much against the Trump administration as a direct reaction to it, which the exit polls confirmed. Then all of a sudden, eight Democrats just kind of rolled over, and they said, okay, Republicans, you can almost have everything you want. Just, what they got was just little chicken feet around the edges, but basically they got what they want. But here's the issue. That only gets us to the end of January, January 30th, to be specific. And with the promise that the Republican Senate will hold a vote on the ACA issues in December at some point. But the Republicans have been adamant, especially Trump, that they absolutely detest the ACA. They think it was a disaster. It's horrible. I can't imagine that after all that, they're going to like say, but sure, we'll extend it for a year, even though we rejected out of hand that offer earlier before the Senate finally agreed to what they did. Where is this going to go next? And what is going to happen to all these people? And will there be another shutdown here in just a few weeks?
Yeah, I agree with everything you said there, Danny. That was very well said. You know, and you've already had Speaker Johnson saying, I'm not going to hold this vote for ACA subsidies.
He's not even going to hold the vote. Said it. The Senate may, but without the vote, the House, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, that's why. And then you can't even have Democrats throw Chuck Schumer out of his position. You know, if someone should be held responsible within the Democratic Party for this failure, this was a failed effort. And it was done. I agree. It was for the right reasons. They were fighting the good fight and then they abandoned it. And someone needs to be held responsible for that. You know, I think the same way, too, this continuing resolution is going to go until the end of January. And then what? And unlike now, where we have the upcoming holidays to restart the government because of the air traffic control situation, I think that was the prime driver in this, is that we've got 2 weeks into the holidays. We need to figure this out because the airports need to be working for the holidays. It's going to be into January. And, you know, maybe some people will get bent out of shape because they're going to miss their Valentine date, you know, someplace or whatever. But there's a long period of time that this country might have to endure before there's some other inflection point where the two parties have to actually come to some form of agreement.
And let's look at that ACA. Do you foresee any probability, any possibility that the Republicans would do something? I mean, if not just extend them for a year, which they said they rejected out of hand, will they do something? Because I saw one report that suggested maybe 52% of those people are actually Republican voters, so they don't want to make their people mad. How do you see that playing out?
I mean, you know, you would think that the Republicans would look at this and say 26 is an election year for the House. Everyone's back at the ballots. One of the things interesting about the eight Democrats or seven plus Angus King that, abandoned the Democrats shutdown was that none of them were up to vote them up for election in 2026. Right. They've all got time. So the idea is that people will forget about this. For the Republicans in the House, people aren't going to forget about this. And, you know, I don't understand that political calculation then to allow people's ACA to double or triple or whatever it is, as is being stated. So it doesn't make that base political sense for them to protect themselves. But I think they feel that they can make the argument that this is the Democrats' fault. So many of them come from districts that are gerrymandered so that they only have to survive their primary challenge. So the concern for them is not going to be a primary challenger who's going to you be yelling about the ACA. It's going to be a primary challenger who's yelling that you defended the ACA. You kept Obamacare in place. And I think the Republican calculation for the 26th cycle is they're more concerned about maintaining their positions and not losing primary challenges than the handful. And we know it's a handful. It's like out of 435 House seats, it's something like only 30 are competitive. And now with all this redistricting that's going around the country, it'll be even less. You're talking about maybe a dozen seats that will be competitive maybe throughout the entire country. So I think that's maybe Johnson and others' calculation is we can handle that. But we got to make sure our primary challengers don't have anything to stand on because they have been beating this Obamacare thing for
that also assumes though, even on the R side, even within a primary issue, that enough of these people don't either lose their coverage or have their premiums go to where they can't afford it, to where they're sick and tired of any R that they don't want in there. So, I mean, districting or not, or, you know, where these competitive are right now. But I mean, it seems to me that there's a real problem that people are going to say, Republicans I'm talking about, Republican voters are going to say, you know, screw you all. I don't care what y'all do. Don't screw with my health care. Is that a possibility? Or do you think that the people will go, yeah, I'll vote for R anyway, even if I lost my health care?
That's a real possibility. I mean, the same thing happens to the Democrats. But I mean, that's a possibility. But I think that they're more concerned with the primary challenger, the primaries, than they are with the general elections. And of course, you have a lot less people turning out to vote. The people who turn out to vote in primaries are usually really pretty hardcore base ideological voters. And these are people who hate Obamacare, even though they're benefiting from it. They hate it, you know. And so I think that's what the calculation is, you know.
And I'm sorry, on that topic, one of the things that Trump said in one of his Truth Social screeds, in the midst of all this, was, you know what? Forget about the ACA at all. Don't extend it. Just get rid of it, period. And let's just give all this money back to all the people and let them get a better one and a higher quality at a lower cost. What a great idea that would be. That brief swell, as we used to say in the military, but that doesn't even exist. That's just a mere fantasy, because there is no such system that could even happen. And they have had, the Republicans, over a decade now to come up with an actual plan, and yet they specifically don't. Why do you suppose that is? I mean, wouldn't it even be in their political interest to say, all right, here's a better plan. You don't like the ACA. You don't like Obamacare. That name is attached to it. Okay, here's one that actually works. Why have they not come up with a plan, and why do their followers continue to be okay with it?
Because I don't think there's anything out there that's going to be better for the health insurance companies than the ACA. I mean, one of the Republican Party talking points on this has been the Democrats want to subsidize private health insurance companies, which is true. That's what essentially you're doing here. You know, now that shouldn't be the case. I believe in having a national healthcare system, a single payer system, Medicare for all, what do you want to call it? But the reality is you can't let, you know, these rates double and triple and quadruple or whatever. As bad as the system is, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I think the reality of the Republicans, because in Trump's first administration, they did try to repeal the ACA a number of times. They could have done it, and they had no alternative. And I believe it's because for the health insurance companies, the ACA is the best thing. This is what many of us who are libertarians, whether you're a left libertarian or a right libertarian, we're saying this is wrong about the ACA. You're forcing people to purchase a product from a private company. you know, the mandate of the ACA, you know, that goes against my right to, you know, to not purchase something from someone if I don't want to. And that, so that's why the ACA is so beneficial from the health insurance, for the health insurance companies, is because people have to purchase their product. And so why would the health insurance companies be okay with Republicans changing that? Now, they could change other aspects of it, but fundamentally redoing the system is not in the best interest of the health insurance company. And the health insurance industry, just like the military industrial complex, just like big agriculture, just like the banking industry, they are supporters of both parties, right? Both parties are beholden to the health insurance company, the health insurance industry. So I think that's the explanation, Danny. I don't think they have anything that's any better that they want to offer. And two, the main thing is, I think it was up to the health insurance company. And we have to remember that this ACA, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, this originally was a Republican plan. You know, this was a conservative plan that comes out of both Massachusetts when Mitt Romney was governor, but also, I believe, out of the Heritage Foundation. I may have my provenance not exactly correct there, but the genesis of this idea of requiring or mandating coverage through private health insurance companies is essentially a Republican plan from the 1990s that the Obama administration utilized, you know, for its own purposes.
I remember Mitt Romney talking that up during his presidential runs and whatnot.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Remember that? Yeah. So, but it is, I mean, and the reality is that most people, living in this country.
So let me ask you something. Speaking of Republicans and the healthcare, one of the presentations that Senator Graham had here recently was he had this big old chart, big pie chart he put up on the Senate floor, and he was showing the evils of the healthcare companies that have like hundreds of millions of dollars a day in profit or revenue, whatever that they draw in. He was talking about all that evil and stuff like that. But don't I recall correctly, and if I am wrong, correct me here, but it seems to me that both Republicans and Democrats get a lot of money from the healthcare industry in terms of campaign financing.
Oh, absolutely. It's massive. It's as big as any other industry, right? I mean, you have, they are going to receive millions upon millions of dollars in the aggregate from the health insurance industry, just as they do from the weapons industry or from the banking industry or from big pharma or from the agriculture industry or from whoever, right? This is the reality of having a government that is a system of legalized bribery. And so you've seen that in statements from Democratic and Republican leaders, but, you know, particularly on the Democratic side. Dick Gephardt years ago spoke in front of a health insurance company forum, a convention, and said, don't worry about it. There'll never be single payer or universal or a national healthcare system here. You know, Hillary Clinton laughed about it when she was asked about it. You know, I mean, you had Joe Biden saying that if it came to his desk, universal healthcare or Medicare for all, he would veto it. I mean, they're so firmly entrenched with these interests, with these donors, that there's no separation. You know, our hope is that you have people from the outside who can shake it loose. And that's a pretty vain hope, I think, you know, but yeah, there's no difference. The reason why we have these policies, the reasons why we have a $1 trillion defense budget, the reason why your school tells you that the pizza sauce on your kid's pizza at lunch counts as a vegetable. You know, I mean, this is all because of these industries that control our government. You know, we talk about the Israel lobby and everything else. The Israel lobby is nothing special. It's just that the Israelis are utilizing the American government through this legalized bribery system in the same way that, you know, how many other industries or how many other special interests are doing it. So
the bottom line to all this part is that it for the American people I'm talking about, it doesn't matter Republican, Democrat, this system, that system, no system. It's going to pretty much stay like it is. And all of the people in the elites in power have incentive to make sure it stays that way. And they'll be punished if they don't go to anything else, whether it's single payer, healthcare for all, something that doesn't even exist yet. Nobody in power wants to change the system because that would upset the financial apple cart. Did I wrap it up so there?
That's absolutely the case. What's the incentive to do so? And even those on the Democratic Party side who spoke about this who've been very eloquent about this, Bernie Sanders, or, you know, certainly you have the squad, say someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they say nothing about Medicare for all at all. I mean, they'll say it now that Trump's in office, knowing that it's an impossibility. But when you have a Democratic president and you have a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House, you hear nothing about it, you know? And so it's something that's tightly controlled in terms of this is something that's useful to speak only when it's not possible. But when it is possible, don't dare bring it up because that threatens our donors. That's threatening.
And so this just has the effect of what you said a minute ago. And by the way, do you have to leave, by the way? Because I know
no,
we're
I'm
a little,
good.
Okay.
Yeah.
This gets back to what you said a second ago, which is just the next piece in the cog that undermines confidence in government, period. Yeah. No matter who's in charge here, by the American people, and they're losing faith in it. Now, one of the other things here that I want to talk about in the last bit of time that we have here, you mentioned it a second ago also, this redistricting thing. So we have President Trump openly saying that he wanted Texas, and now it turns out to be a handful of other states as well, to redistrict for the exclusive, express, and unhidden reason to get additional Republican seats that I'm entitled to, was the phrase that he used.
Right.
And so you had the Democratic governor in California saying, okay, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We're going to do the same thing. Prop 50 just passed a week ago on Tuesday. And so now then they're going to be looking for the same thing to get 5 Democratic seats. And in both cases, what you have is the party leadership in each country placing the priority of the party above the needs of the people in their state. And so the Texans have prioritized Republicans, Democrats in California. And they're saying that anybody in all of these areas that you're doing that are of the wrong party have been disenfranchised. Your votes will no longer count. There's no point in you even going to the polls anymore. Straight up, that's the case here. Now, those are in two pockets here, but what does that do, Matt, to the integrity of the entire system that people across the country see?
Oh, it just makes it out to be a farce, right? It just makes it out to be empty and vapid, superficial, to be nothing more than a state controlled by two parties that represent the same major interests, whose whole purpose is to keep themselves in power. When you have a two-party system, it's pretty easy for each side to receive their share. And you look at it here in the United States, every 4 or 8 years, the other party takes the White House, the House goes back and forth, the Senate goes back and forth, each party has roughly the same amount of governorships. I know the Republicans have some more, but the Democratic states are bigger. Same with the state legislatures. So there's a sharing of power here. They all agree fundamentally on the major issues, the life and death issues. They're all capitalist. They're all under the thumb of their donors and the interests that they represent. And so they only can differentiate themselves on identity. And this is why we have this scourge of identity politics in the United States and cultural issues that they campaign on and that they argue about. And that's meant to have the American electorate identify as either red or blue in a tribal or a team manner. So that's the reality of American politics. It's something that's dominated by money, controlled by the wealthy. And essentially, it's just one aspect of, what is the ruling class. And there are divisions, there are hierarchies, there's cliques in all this. But if anyone thinks that just because the Republicans argue against the Democrats and vice versa, that they're not in the same club, if you will, as George Carlin would say, you're simply not understanding how the system actually works. Yes, they want seats. They want their positions of power that are limited within the structure, and they will fight each other for it. But their first priority is to maintain the structure as it is. That's why this idea that you're ever going to get someone in a Democratic Party or Republican Party who's going to create fundamental change is just unsound. There's no incentive to do that. There's no incentive to really pull down the facilities and institution of power and rebuild them, because that would cut your own throat. That would cause you to lose power, the seat that you have, the power that you have. And who is going to do that? what politician is going to do that? So, you know, you have those who run independently. You know, both you and I have our experiences, quixotic, romantic, if you will, noble, maybe, but ultimately fool's errands, right? It, because of the Leviathan that we're up against is so massive that to try and fight it symmetrically makes no sense. You're not going to get anywhere. So you have to figure out a way, I think, and I'm not sure what this is, how we change our country asymmetrically with our actions, because certainly going and voting red or blue is just going to continue the problems and the troubles and the issues that we have.
And you know, for those who may have seen it, brother Elon Musk says, hey, you know what? How about a new party, the American Party? That's what we want. Something that'll help the American people by having another super rich billionaire who's kind of weird, chaotic. That's gonna give us. Now, I actually saw, let me see, let me kind of do a little bit on here. I saw this, if I can pull it back up. They're saying that, well, this isn't the one here, but they actually said, Wall Street Journal apparently said, yeah, he's now kind of saying, well, maybe not. Maybe I'm not going to. Puts the pause on that. So I think he's starting to realize just how hard that is. But, I mean, if a guy with the unlimited resources that Elon Musk has is not going to have any prospect on this, what would it take for there to be a new party? Because I'll just preface before you answer by saying I think that there will be one. But my guess in my gut tells me it's only going to come after a profound dysfunction to the point of possibly even bloodshed, possibly even some right. sort of version of a civil war, to where it's not just that where you're rolling your eyes and the government can't even do its job. It can't pass a budget. But I mean, like literally it can't govern at all. And now all of a sudden you have across the board, people can't get food. They can't get health care. They can't get a job and nothing is working. And then you have the potential for something. But I fear that it can only come after that. And I hope that you're about to tell me that, no, there is an asymmetrical way that can prevent us even getting to the violent issue. What is it?
I don't know, Danny. I wish I knew. I mean, the idea of the political structure as it is so besotted with money. Right. I mean, so if you want to run just even in my local town races here, 55,000 people in our town, candidates are spending $15,000, $20,000, maybe even $25,000 for the town council race. You know, I mean, so there is just that hindrance, that obstacle of money and how money controls and money decides that is very, very difficult. If that was the case, you know, that, let me start over again then, because like, you know, what you're asking for is a solution here. And I mean, you can go back to the Pat ones of worker strikes and organizing at that level and shutting down the system and then building from a base grassroots effort that would bring you forward a populist candidate like we saw, say, at the end of the 19th century, or even like we saw like in the 1850s with the Republican Party, you know. I just think that the system as it is right now is so controlled, it's so structured that, and the way our society is, that we're so dependent upon information coming through digital sources, that for a movement to get going, it's going to require so much money, so much support that it will, and it might be successful to begin with, and last a year or two, and we could talk about all different types of movements like that. You go back to, say, the teacher strike, the teacher strikes from 4 or 5 years ago, how successful they were. But where did it go to? What did it build into? You can point to Black Lives Matter, 25 million people on the street in the summer of 2020. Where did that go? What happened? You know, I mean, so it's this idea of that. Yeah, we certainly can get things moving forward. We can have grassroots efforts that mobilize millions, tens of millions of people. The problem is sustaining it. The problem is keeping it going. And that is the issue that I find difficult to crack when you're talking about how you force change in the political system, because it is existential for the duopoly. It is existential for the system we have in place here. That we have to exist with. And the idea being is that, say, someone like Elon Musk, who does have the type of money that you're talking about, if he was able to then force change, if he was able to insert himself through his candidates in key races around the country and disturbed the very well manipulated, very well manicured or controlled election process here. Again, everything's gerrymandered. So if you're able to throw some sand into the gears and screw things up in one or two places, the parties will take knowledge, right? They'll take notice. That's the theory behind it. That's the theory behind independent politics, third party politics. You're not running to win, you're running to make change. So that if you cause a problem for the Democrats and they lose a U.S. Senate seat or they lose House seats because they candidates that are running on universal health care or Medicare for all got votes and took votes away from the Democratic candidate. And in a three-way loss, the Democratic candidate who should have won in this gerrymandered district didn't win because the vote was split between a liberal and a leftist candidate. Well, that the theory is that would cause the Democratic Party to then say, you know what, we need to reevaluate here. Maybe we should be embracing more leftist policies, more policies like universal health care or Medicare for all. That's the theory. I've not really seen that play out. I've not seen it work, whether in a sense of you have that ability to disrupt the election and cause change, or when the disruptions occur, you often see the Democratic Party doubling down. Now, the Tea Party was successful through this with the Republicans going back 15 years. They essentially put a gun to the Republican Party's head and said, if you do not follow our lead, if you do not follow our principles, if you do not remain committed to a conservative agenda, we will leave the Republican Party and then you will lose against the Democrats. And the Republican Party adopted that. They followed that lead. They did as the Tea Party demanded. And if people remember at that time, going back 13 years, you had he was the House Republican whip, and the Tea Party defeated him. And I think people thought the same might happen with the Democratic Party, where AOC defeats in 2018 the third ranking member of the Democrats in the U.S. House. And she defeats the right. And, you know, I think there is thoughts that, oh, the Democrats will now start to listen. And what we've seen with Mamdani, people are saying, well, the Democrats will start to listen. But no, they won't. They'll try and cut their losses. They'll try and triangulate. They'll try and do whatever they can to preserve their power without affecting their donors and the interests that they represent, and not listen to the public who wants something different.
Well, listen, I'll tell you, Matt, and I'll tell this to everybody who's listening as well. My view is that because when you look at all the things we've been talking about in this episode, to include going to war, violating international law, shredding the U.S. Constitution, ignoring our domestic laws, even in pursuit of power, and then now then things that are affecting the lives of regular Americans here, and how the government is growing more and more dysfunction while the elite are consolidating power to prevent things like what you're talking about from actually succeeding. We are entering into, if we're not already there, into an eventual death spiral. Mm-hmm. Every country, every empire, every that has existed in history eventually falls. And of course, a lot of people have talked about that. I've done a number of shows called the Next American Civil War, part whatever, and we'll continue to do that here. But at the governance level, forget about the policies for the moment. It's the system of governance that we have that will eventually destroy us all if we don't find some way to have an asymmetrical change, as you just mentioned, that can stop the check the slide and to turn it back around to where it can continue to live for some other longer period of time. Because if we don't get this, then you jump in if you disagree with me. If we don't change this and find some asymmetrical, nonviolent way to get this boat back unfloating and stop some of the bleeding, we're going to get into a situation where the only thing left is a violent eruption. And I fear that day.
Right. I mean, certainly all the metrics are there, right? All the statistics are there. You know, I just looked it up again the other day. It's now up to over 65% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. That's the latest understanding. And about half of people who make over $100,000 a year are living paycheck to paycheck. This idea there's a differentiation between the working class and the middle class, I don't really think that's true anymore. Certainly there is differences, you know, don't get me wrong, but when you're living paycheck to paycheck, regardless of your working class or middle class, there's an anxiety, a fear, a frustration, an anger that you're living with the entire time. And all these other issues, all the overhead that we're all consumed by, our healthcare costs, our education costs, our utilities costs, it's just putting a burden on people. And then you look and you see the elite getting away with it, right? You see the elite being able to live differently than we are. Or you see that it is, as George Carlin, one big club and you're not a part of it. Dick Cheney dies. And Nancy Pelosi and Bill Clinton and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are writing these gorgeous eulogies for that war criminal, right? And you say, what am I doing here? Why am I taking part? And then you drop out, or you become apathetic, or you feel that nothing you can do is going to matter. But then at some point, to your what you're saying, Danny, it's going to get where there is a breaking point. Right. There is a where the response is going to be violent. And, you know, certainly a nation with this degree of wealth inequality, with the haves versus the have nots the way they are, history tells us that something like that is nearly inevitable. So how do we find something that counters and reverses the degradation and the deterioration and the demise of our country? And it's very difficult because the ruling class is so good at putting things into place to hinder, right? I mean, so look at unions. You would think, let's do it through the unions. Let's have a general strike, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The unions have been so broken, dismantled, co-opted in this country for decades by both Republicans and Democrats that their power to do what they did in the 19th century is, it's not there. It's not there. And the process to rebuild that is going to take decades. You know, I mean, so I agree with everything you're saying. And, you know, I'm sitting here with this frustration of, you know, being a talking head and not being able to provide any solution for this. I will say that, as my friend Eleanor said to me over the weekend, you know, we're all grains of sand. But it doesn't take many grains of sand banded together to stop the machine. Right. So I think that there are solutions out there. And the problem being is that we have to be organized enough to implement them. It's very difficult, though. It's very difficult.
Yeah, it is. And I pray for that nonviolent way to be found. Certainly worked when Martin Luther King Jr. Applied it. Maybe one of the only ones we've ever had to be able to stand up to that kind of pressure. But we sure need another one.